To the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Hurtado. Captain Adler, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Murphy, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. Appellant respectfully requests 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Counsel, could you add this? Yeah. Thank you.
The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he suppressed Cadet Hurtado's statement, as he found Cadet Hurtado invoked his right to counsel and the special agent should have concluded the interview upon his unequivocal and unambiguous invocation. The military judge made findings of facts and conclusions of law in his ruling, which are correct, supported by the record, and are not clearly erroneous. This court is bound by the military judge's factual determinations unless they are unsupported by the record or clearly erroneous. Under an Article 62, this court reviews the military judge's decision directly and reviews a motion to suppress for an abuse of discretion. This court must review the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party at trial, which is Cadet Hurtado.
So, counsel, let's explore that a little bit. I'm sure we'll be discussing at some great length the meaning and import of the word but in the context of the statement made by your client when speaking to CID. But I'd like to take a step back and look at the bigger picture. In your view, is it correct to say that with Miranda and Davis and the other cases in this sphere, that the point of those was to ensure that an accused A knows of his or her right to counsel, and B, to ensure that the suspect is not in any way coerced or tricked into giving up that constitutional right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So upon viewing the video of the interrogation here, where do we find any indication that there was a coercive atmosphere or that your client was badgered or that in any other way his will was overborne here when it came to the invocation of his right to counsel?
Well, Your Honor, in the military judge's ruling, JA 122 to 125, the military judge did not find that his will was overborne. And though the defense, in their motion to suppress, raised that argument, the military judge did not make that factual finding or that conclusion of law. And so the military judge focused on the words that Cadet Hurtado stated, that being the unequivocal and unambiguous invocation. And at that point, the interview should have been concluded and nothing further should have happened. Under Davis, if it is equivocal or ambiguous, then the special agent could have asked follow-up questions to clear that ambiguity. However, that is not applicable here.
So, understandably, your point is it was unambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're using an objective standard in determining that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, where do we find that in terms of when the word but was used, doesn't that introduce a area of ambiguity where it would be appropriate? It would be rather silly, wouldn't it, to say after somebody says but in the middle of invoking counsel, law enforcement, you can't simply ask, so you're invoking counsel?
Your Honor, I think it's important to look at the words that follow but. The statement did not end at the word but. It ended at yeah. That is affirming what Cadet Hurtado had said previously, that he would like to speak to a lawyer. There was no ambiguity in the front part of that sentence, and there's nothing that the but is in fact contrasting. And that is the definition of what the word but is supposed to do. But here, all it is contrasting, it is not contrasting anything. It is in fact affirming the first part of that sentence, that he would like to speak to a lawyer.
Now, are you saying that but reaffirms what he's saying, or the word yeah, or the words yeah, is essentially ratifying what he initially said?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Here we are in Article 62, and so that lends light to a few additional standards that this court must abide by. This court and a reviewing court may not find its own facts or substitute its own interpretation of those facts under Becker.
But, counsel, it seems like the case law says that the determination whether the invocation of his right to counsel was unequivocal or not is a question of law that we review de novo. So at least for that question, do we owe any deference to the military judge?
Your Honor, that is correct. IAEA says that, as well as a recent case that the government cites, Wicks, says that when it's a mixed question of law and fact, the military judge abuses his discretion if the findings of fact are clearly erroneous or his conclusions of law are incorrect.
And when I look at these cases, it seems like many of them are from older times when we don't all have the video, right? Everybody on this side of the bar probably has watched the video. Right, certainly we all have. And so we can watch the video, we can hear the tone that the CCA refers to, we can watch it all play out. But 20, 30 years ago, there was a question. There was no video, maybe there was audio. And the case law seems to say the military judge gets deference in determining exactly what was said by whom to whom. But then once that's determined, it's a question of law that gets reviewed by appellate courts de novo, whether or not the invocation was unequivocal. So is the right thing, we can, all five of us, we can go back, we can watch the video, and we don't owe any deference, I believe, to the military judge about whether or not we believe that invocation was unequivocal. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. Deference should be given to the military judge. And the military judge's findings of fact must be reviewed, and they are not to be overturned unless they're clearly
erroneous. Well, what finding of fact that he made is relevant to the question of whether his invocation was unequivocal?
Your Honor, the finding of fact that Special Agent Lucas first acknowledged Cadet Hurtado's invocation by saying, "That's okay," and then re-asked the same question, and this is on JA-124. That is support in the record that shows she knew that it was not ambiguous or equivocal and that no follow-up questions.
Now, we're sort of reading into the military judge, I think, is suggesting in his ruling what he interpreted the statement "that's okay" to mean. He certainly implies what it seems from reading his ruling that he thought she was saying, "I affirm that you have asked for a lawyer and that's okay, you can do that, but now I'm going to tell you all this other information." But he doesn't say that in his ruling, does he?
He does not explicitly say that, no, Your Honor. But again, under the 62 standard, his findings of fact, he does not abuse his discretion.
Well, what is the finding of fact? The finding of fact is that she said, after your client made his response, she said, "That's okay." And the rest of her, like the transcript that we get from the military judge, that's fairly, I think, a finding of fact, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And additionally, this court said in Black that if this court were to disagree with what the military judge did down below, that a mere difference of opinion is not enough and does not reach the standard of abuse of discretion. So while this court may look at the video and come to a different conclusion than the military judge, that is not an abuse of discretion under an Article 62.
Do you concede that, at least under Davis, if we believe there was some ambiguity, that a window was opened by your client's statement, that the CID agent was legally authorized to ask clarifying questions?
If a reasonable police officer, the standard being under Davis that if a reasonable police officer believed there was ambiguity, then yes, they have the ability to ask those follow-up
right.
questions.
And it's not just authorized, right? They call it good police work, right? I'd say it's sort of encouraged, right? The court has said if you don't know whether they're invoked or not, you should ask a follow-up question, right? And that's exactly what the CID agent did here, right?
We agree that she asked she re-asked the same question, Your Honor. But before she did that, she acknowledged his unequivocal and unambiguous invocation by saying, "That's okay." And it's exactly at that same second when you watch the video at timestamp 3020, he finishes saying, "But yeah," she immediately says, "That's okay." She doesn't say, you know, "Help me understand what you would like," or ask a different question, a clarifying question. She reasks the same question with the word "so" in front of it, indicating that she knew exactly what Cadet Hurtado asked for. Additionally, Your Honors, the military judge did not make any clearly erroneous factual findings. The Army Court indicated that the military judge found that Special Agent Lucas interjected to further explain the rights. However, that is not a clearly erroneous factual finding. There is support in the record that shows she did interject, interrupt, involve herself in that conversation. Additionally, this took place after the invocation, and Smith and De La Rosa tell us that in order to review an invocation for ambiguity and clarity, we look at what happens before the invocation and concurrent with the invocation, not what happens afterwards.
But along those lines, you're citing what the CID agent said after the invocation to support your position. So are you saying concurrent in a context where it's anything touching upon the invocation, or are you saying once, in your view, there's an unambiguous invocation, can't look at anything that happens afterwards?
Your Honor, you cannot look at anything that happens afterwards.
So what's then the relevance of what the CID agent said?
Yes, Your Honor. The relevance is that this is not a clearly erroneous factual finding. And for the military judge to abuse his discretion, one of the reasons would be to have clearly erroneous factual findings. And so Appellant Cadet Hurtado is just making the point that that is not a clearly erroneous factual finding in the military judge's ruling, and therefore he should be afforded great deference, and he did not abuse his discretion. Your Honor, the military judge considered all elements of the invocation, including his gestures and the rising pitch of his voice. While he does not explicitly use those words in his ruling, he cites to the applicable timestamps of when the invocation occurred on the video. And additionally, on page JA-149, we know that the military judge watched the invocation during the motion to suppress. So we know that those facts were considered. And again, that he did not abuse his discretion when he suppressed Cadet Hurtado's statement. His findings of facts and conclusions of law are supported by the record and are not clearly erroneous. Because this court must review in the light most favorable to the party who prevailed at trial, the appellant, Cadet Hurtado, there must be more than a mere difference of opinion to establish an abuse of discretion. We ask this court to uphold the decision and return to the Judge Advocate General of the Army for remand, pending any questions.
Yeah, I have one question, and it goes back to the Chief's question about what exactly we're trying to protect the accused from when he or she is in one of these interrogations. And we certainly are, it seems to me, we're certainly trying to protect him or her against coercive conditions that might result in a statement against his or her interests. But isn't one of the other things that we're trying to prevent is that we don't want an accused to invoke his rights only to be talked out of it later? I mean, you don't have to necessarily be coercive, but once, if it is determined in this case that the accused did in fact invoke, you wouldn't want a situation, I wouldn't think, that the law would allow you to, okay, let's talk him out of it kindly and nicely. I mean, isn't that a concern as well? I don't know. It seems like it should be.
It is, Your Honor, and just like other cases where the agents would go back in and ask for the PIN code, right? They're asking for more information after the appellant had invoked. Again, that is something that we would be protecting. But here, since we are in Article 62, deference must be afforded to the military judge, and this court must look at his ruling directly to determine if he abused his discretion. And so Cadet Hurtado unambiguously invoked his right to counsel, and Special Agent Lucas continued to question him, and at that point the interview should have been suppressed, as the military judge did below.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Adler. Captain Murphy.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Murphy, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Guarini, represent the United States. We ask this court to affirm the ruling of the Army Court and find first that the military judge's conclusion of law that appellant unequivocally invoked his right to counsel was incorrect, and second, that the military judge clearly erred in making his findings of fact. Turning to my first point, in Davis, the Supreme Court held that an accused must articulate his desire to have counsel present sufficiently clearly such that a reasonable officer in the circumstances would understand his request to be one for an attorney. This determination of whether an invocation is equivocal is an objective one based on how a reasonable officer would view the comments. Here, nowhere does the military judge cite to this operative language, this reasonable officer test from Davis, and nowhere does he apply the reasonable officer test to the facts of this case. Instead, he seems to have substituted his own subjective judgment for that of a reasonable officer.
So what do we do with the presumption that a military judge knows the law and applies the law?
Yes, Your Honor, but here where the military judge omitted key facts and he made clearly erroneous findings of fact and he focused on the incorrect legal question, this is enough to overcome that presumption in this case. The only conclusion that the military judge makes about the accused's invocation is at the bottom of JA 124, when he writes, "Here the accused invoked his right to counsel after being asked by the agent if he wanted to speak to an attorney, when he stated, 'I mean, I would like to speak to a lawyer, but yeah.' Here the appellant's invocation was not sufficiently clear such that a reasonable officer in the circumstances would have understood his request for an attorney."
I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. So, counsel, what are we to make of the appellant's argument that in looking at it from, as you say, the perspective of a reasonable officer, agent, the fact that the CID agent acknowledged the invocation by saying, "Okay," and then says, "So," and repeats the statement, "So you want to have an attorney?"
Your Honor, the government doesn't agree that that statement from the agent is the agent acknowledging that she understands appellant's invocation. Instead, the footage demonstrates that after the agent says that she pauses and then she asks a follow-up clarifying question. So it's apparent from her reaction that it was not clear to her whether appellant was invoking or not, and so therefore it was proper for her to ask follow-up clarifying questions under Davis. Here, appellant used the words, "I would like to speak with a lawyer, but, yeah." The use of "but" juxtaposed with this phrase, "I would like to speak with a lawyer," introduced ambiguity. There are two equally plausible interpretations of the words that appellant used. One is that "I would like to speak with a lawyer," but the other is, "I think I would like to speak with a lawyer at some point, but I'm not sure right now." This is ambiguous enough such that a reasonable officer...
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, the statement doesn't say, "I want to speak to a lawyer, but I don't know." It says, "I want to speak to a lawyer, hesitate, but yeah." That sounds like, "But yeah, I do want to speak to a lawyer."
Your Honor...
I mean, a reasonable... I mean, I'm not a police officer, but I think I'm a reasonable guy. That sounds to me like someone saying, "Yeah, I want to speak to a lawyer."
Your Honor, the government doesn't agree that the use of yeah, at the end of appellant's sentence is appellant affirming his original idea that he would like to speak to a lawyer. But
how else is it to be interpreted? I mean, if that you every now and then that English minor comes in handy. So the you say that the "but" usually introduces a contrasting clause. But then you look at that final clause, yeah, that is in fact affirming what was the original clause. So I'm how else is that yeah to be interpreted?
Your Honor, this is the use of yeah at the end of appellant's statement is suggesting that appellant had another thought to add to the conversation that he had not yet articulated out loud to the agent.
Yeah, but counsel, then how can we, if he's not articulating it, are we expecting that the agent's going to be a mind reader and know, oh, he has some other thought, so let me ask a follow-up question, notwithstanding the fact that he just clearly invoked?
No, Your Honor, the agent doesn't need to be a mind reader. But the appellant's statement is ambiguous enough that it's appropriate for the agent to ask those follow-up questions to determine what the accused's intention was behind those words so that she can properly discern what his intent was and she can know whether he is, in fact, invoking his right to counsel. But assuming that the use of yeah is as appellant has proposed, this would mean that he's changed his mind twice in one sentence, which would be equivocating. So it was reasonable for the officer to ask those clarifying questions to properly determine the accused's intent. The words used by appellant here are similar to those that were used in Davis v. United States. In that case, the accused said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. And the Supreme Court upheld law enforcement conduct in that case, saying that it was proper for the agents to ask those follow-up clarifying questions when they were faced with a statement that to the officers seemed to be ambiguous. So here, similar to Davis, we have a phrase that would be an invocation on its own, but is juxtaposed with this word that injects ambiguity. In Davis, that word was maybe, and here, that word is but. In Davis, the court wrote that these clarifying questions protect the rights of the suspect and help the agent from second-guessing as to what the suspect meant. And that's exactly what the agent did here. Because the agent was given a statement that to her seemed to be ambiguous, she proceeded to ask him follow-up questions to determine his intent. An appellant went on to give her answers that reasonably conflicted with that first statement, like, yeah, I want to know what I'm here for first. So she clarified whether he wanted an attorney before she proceeded at all to the substantive portion of the interview. These clarifying questions were the behavior of a reasonable officer.
All of that makes perfect sense if you are arguing before the military judge. But here we are at the Court of Appeals. Could you please wrestle with the issues that were raised by Judge Hardy? What is really the standard of review of this court when we have the ability to actually look at exactly what the military judge was looking at? We're not granting deference in the context of military judge viewing the demeanor of a witness and so forth, where this court would not have that ability. What do we do with abuse of discretion, clearly erroneous, all those standards, in concrete terms, when this court can actually see precisely what the military judge was saying in making his ruling?
Well, Your Honor, it's true that in Article 62, there is traditionally deference to that military judge's decision. But it is also true that the court cannot find a new facts in an Article 62 appeal. But the court doesn't need to find any new facts here to decide the issue today, because whether the accused invoked his right to counsel is a question of law that the court can determine by looking only at the plain language of the words that appellant used in this case. As to my second point, the military judge clearly erred because he omitted key facts, and his finding that the agent interjected to explain the process for getting an attorney is not fairly supported by the record.
So is your point right now the argument in the alternative, or does this fit into your argument about the authority that this court has to look for itself what actually occurred?
Your Honor, it's in addition to the question of law, just highlighting some additional errors or omissions that the judge made. But the court doesn't need to find these facts or find alternative facts to decide that first question.
Counsel, is this whole case essentially turn on whether or not the invocation was unequivocal?
Your Honor, it turns on whether a reasonable officer would have found appellant's statement to be an equivocal invocation or not.
Right. And if we think that it was unequivocal, there's just no path for the government to win here, right?
Well, Your Honor, the question would be if the reasonable officer could not have found it to be equivocal. But the military judge could have still abused his discretion under the standard of review if he omitted those key facts or if he made clearly erroneous findings of fact.
Well, would there be any path? I mean, if we believe, I'm just going to keep using the shorthand, that it was unequivocal. I know that's not the standard. There's nothing more they can say, right? The interrogation has to stop, right, at that point. So if I don't really see how we could, especially given the difficult posture that the government finds it in this case, how we could possibly get to concluding that the military judge abused his discretion.
Well, Your Honor, the government would highlight that nowhere does the military judge use the key legal test and analyze that test given the facts of this case.
And, counsel, your argument, the key legal test being Davis, the reasonable officer?
Yes, Your Honor, that okay. Reasonable officer language from Davis.
But this goes back to Judge Hardy's point. If the military judge, as he did, or she did, I don't know what the gender was, concludes that the invocation was not equivocal, is there a need to go? You don't get to Davis unless you conclude that the invocation was equivocal.
Your Honor, the government would propose that the proper lens to view appellants or an accused statement is that lens of how a reasonable officer would view the invocation, whether the reasonable officer believes that it's equivocal or unequivocal. And here, in his opinion, nowhere does the military judge cite to this objective language. Nowhere does he conduct this objective inquiry. Instead, he summarily includes that the accused invoked his right to counsel, which suggests that he seems to have substituted his own subjective judgment for that of a reasonable officer.
And, counsel, on the flip side of this, if we think it was unequivocal, then does anything else the military judge said? Like, yeah, I know you want to make the point that the government thinks some of his findings of facts were clear and erroneous, but does anything else he said really matter? Because once he puts himself in the unequivocal request for counsel bucket, all of his analysis is sort of tainted by that decision, right? Doesn't this sort of all turn? It seems like this threshold question of whether or not the request for counsel was unequivocal or should have been viewed so in the eyes of a reasonable officer, like, controls everything else. And does the government agree that we review that question de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. The government agrees that the conclusion of law, whether appellant unequivocally or equivocally invoked his right to counsel, is a de novo review.
And does then that sort of override all of the other standards of review that are in play here, the appellant, they won below, this is an Article 62. Does anything else really matter once we get past that threshold de novo question of whether or not the invocation was unequivocal?
Your Honor, the government would argue that de novo review is the primary argument, yes.
Counsel, may I ask you about the CCA's opinion where it addresses the intonation and the gestures of the accused? I watched the video, as everybody else has. Can you explain that? What is the government's view with respect to the intonation and the gestures? What were they, and what do they show?
Your Honor, the government's argument is that the tone and the gestures used by the appellant support the argument that he was making an ambiguous or an equivocal invocation of his right to counsel. And the military judge.
But can you explain how does that work? I mean, I watched it, and I just don't really understand what was it about the tone that made it ambiguous, and what gesture did he make that made it ambiguous?
Your Honor, the appellant, his tone of voice sort of trails up as the sentence at issue goes on, which suggests that he's asking a question. And he very slightly turns his hand outward as if to say, I'm not sure, which was enough for the reasonable officer here, this agent, to ask that follow-up question to determine what actually is appellant saying here. Is he invoking or is he not? But the military judge didn't make any findings about appellant's tone or the context surrounding the interview or provide any analysis as to why he thought a reasonable officer could not have found the statements to be equivocal.
So, and, well, counsel, to go back, I think Chief had asked, Bubonic instructs that a military judge is supposed to consider the totality of the circumstances in determining whether an invocation is equivocal or not. The fact that the military judge included the time hacks and those type of indicators in his findings and analysis, why would we not then grant the military judge the deference that he considered the totality of the circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, there are two things I'd like to highlight here. The first is that the judge merely citing to the timestamps in the interview isn't enough. We can't assume what the judge meant to say. We can only look at the text of his opinion and what he actually wrote. As this court wrote in Finch, where an evidentiary issue is complex and or merits a written filing by the party, we deem it appropriate for the military judge to place on the record their reasoning behind the resolution of that issue. So given this court's language and how extensively this issue of whether appellant's alleged invocation was equivocal or not based on the words that he used and the tone that he used, it wasn't reasonable for the judge to not place any analysis on the record and explain how a reasonable officer could not have found this statement to be equivocal. The second thing that I'd like to highlight, Your Honor, you mentioned the totality of the circumstances. And on JA 124 to 125, the judge directly follows his conclusion that appellant invoked with the language, given the totality of the circumstances, the interview should have stopped. And then he cites to Mitchell and the rule for evidence for the waiver of the right to counsel. And the government would highlight that these are distinct legal issues. In Mitchell, there was no question about whether the accused's invocation was equivocal. And the question of whether the accused waived his right to counsel is a distinct analysis from invocation. So instead, under Edwards, first prong, and Davis, the military judge should have followed up with an analysis of the reasonable officer instead of invoking this totality of the circumstances language that is really from the voluntariness of a confession and the waiver of the right to counsel.
Well, those are, counsel, those are two different things. I mean, because Bubonics is discussing invocation, but I think what I'm hearing you say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, essentially is that what government is arguing is that that the military judge erred, made a legal error, citing to the wrong law, the wrong case law, in support of his conclusion that there had been an invocation. Meaning, you're saying he cited to waiver case law as opposed to citing to the invocation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yep. Finally, the military judge's finding that the agent interjected appellant to explain the process for getting counsel is not fairly supported by the record. Again, on JA 124, the military judge writes, the agent responded by first acknowledging appellant's answers, stating that's okay, and then re-asking the question a second time, so you want a lawyer at this time? The agent then interjected to explain to appellant what the process would be like if he decided to ask for a lawyer. And there are three points that I'd like to highlight here. First, that the way this is written suggests that the agent has interjected herself, which is not a logical sequence of events. Second, a review of the footage demonstrates that the agent did not interject or interrupt appellant. At 30 minutes and 20 seconds after the agent asked a clarifying question, appellant had started another sentence saying, I don't, and then he trailed off, at which point the agent tried to acknowledge it was okay that appellant wasn't sure, and she tried to provide some additional clarification. And finally, the military judge follows this fact with his conclusion that appellant invoked, which suggests that he did consider this erroneous interjection in drawing his ultimate legal conclusion.
So your beef is with the use of the word interject?
Yes, for this particular issue, Your Honor.
And then your other reasons for supporting your argument are based on the word but, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't that kind of a grudging view of the right to counsel afforded a military accused to kind of just focus on those two things?
Your Honor, I see that my time is expired.
Please respond to Judge Sparks.
Thank you,
Your Honor. I'm not suggesting, you know, I'm not beating up on you, but answer that question. I mean, you might have a different view, but what's the government's view?
Yes, Your Honor. So the accused doesn't need to speak like an Oxford Don, as the Supreme Court has said, but he does need to provide an answer that's clear enough for that reasonable officer to understand that he's invoking. And the Supreme Court has been clear that the intent of this Davis language, this reasonable officer test, is to provide, in part, guidance to the officers in the field. So this need for effective law enforcement prevents law enforcement from making difficult judgment calls about whether the
accused. Yeah, so basically, the reasonable officer, I mean, it doesn't matter what Sparks thinks or what you think or what anybody else does. It's an objective standard, right, is what you're telling me?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand.
Any further questions? Seeing none, you may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. For these reasons, we ask this court to affirm the ruling of the Army Court. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Murphy. Captain Adler.
The government believes that the military judge omitted key facts. The military judge did not omit key facts, and they cite Finch for this proposition. However, Finch is much different than the case here. In Finch, there was no analysis made by the military judge. Here, we have a ruling on JA 122 to 125, where the military judge analyzes, he cites the appropriate case law, and while he doesn't say reasonable officer, he cites to Davis on JA 124, so we know that the military judge use that in his analysis.
Well, I think one of the questions is how much is enough? I mean, how much does the military judge have to say? I think the government's arguing that there's just not he didn't say enough here. So yeah. How much is enough?
Your Honor, because this is a 62, unless the military judge abuses his discretion, what he decided is enough. And I know that the government mentioned that if there are two plausible results, the military judge made his decision. And unless that decision was an abuse of discretion, and when you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant, this court must affirm the military judge's finding. Pending any questions, Your Honor.
I have a question. We've talked a lot about the question of whether or not the invocation was unequivocal. Let's say that we decide that it wasn't unequivocal. Is there still, given the standard of review and the posture of this case, is there still a path for you to win? And if so, can you lay that out? Like, is it sort of undermine the military judge's entire analysis if we disagree on that sort of threshold question?
Your Honor, this Court's mere disagreement is not enough to overturn. That's set in Black, and therefore, if this Court merely disagrees that if they were sitting as a military judge, they believe it was equivocal, that is not enough to overturn the military judge's decision.
Okay, but write that. We got to sit down and write that, right? And that's hard. So lay it out for me. What would the outline of that opinion be like? So we decide that the invocation was unequivocal, and that Davis authorizes follow-on questions, but it still wasn't an abuse of discretion for the military judge in this case to suppress the statement. So how do we get there?
That's correct. In this case, because we are under an Article 62, if we were not in this posture, the result may be different, Your Honor. But because we are in an Article 62, this Court must abide by the Article 62 standards. Otherwise, the government can do a 62 anytime, and this court would then make their own step into the shoes of the military judge, and that's not what this court has set precedent to do. This court is to review it in light most favorable to the prevailing party at trial. And if they disagree with the military judge, unfortunately, under an Article 62, that is not enough.
Any further questions? Thank you, Captain Nadler. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
The court stands in recess until 10:25.